Well, hello and welcome to this week's episode of A Photographic Life and the continuation of the conversation with myself and Bill Shapiro. This week, it's episode 2 of our discussion around editorial photography, something Bill and I know a little bit about because Bill was a magazine editor for Life magazine. He's worked on magazines for many years. He's also a curator on photography, a writer on photography, a mentor to photographers. And my background is similar in that I've also been a magazine person for many years as an art director, creative director. I've edited magazines. And as well as that, for the last 25 years, I've worked as an editorial photographer. I've also been a filmmaker, lecturer, curator, and many other things. So, both Bill and I have got a bit of experience in these worlds. Let's see what the conversation took us to and where it took us to, shall we? Okay, so Bill, welcome back to the conversation, and we've got part two talking about editorial photography, magazines, and all of that stuff.
I'm ready. It's a subject, as you know, that is near and dear to my heart, even if it makes me sad to talk about it.
Well, I think that was one of the problems, wasn't it, that we experienced in the last episode when we were talking about this, was that, you know, we were slightly nervous about coming over as being too downbeat and too kind of depressed and, you know, two old men talking about the golden days. But I think we escaped falling into that hole. Certainly a lot of the feedback we got suggested that that was the case. But this time we want to try and be positive, as always, and try and find out exactly kind of where we are now.
Yeah, I think where we are now, and also given where we are now, is there any advice we can give to photographers to help them sort of capture some of the things that are now missing, or somehow not recreate, but get some of the benefits of, you know, what you and I sort of grew up with? And hopefully that will be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to start off positive, but I'm going to start off dubious. I'm just not sure. I don't know what you think, whether or not we're in a stage at the moment where we should be trying to recreate what was or trying to find something new.
Well, I think recreate was probably a bad choice of words, but I think there are things that people should try to make up for. You know, one of the things that I do want to talk about today, and I did speak to some, you know, quite excellent photographers who mentioned this, is that social connection between photographer and photo editor, art director, photo team, client, retoucher, and to some degree subject is diminished. And I personally believe that that kind of social contact and give and take of ideas and developing a story or concept together is important. And so if that's harder to get now, I think it's still worth photographers thinking creatively about how to bring that back into their, or how to sort of inject that into their practice if it's not there.
Yeah, I agree. But I think there's also, maybe we should break this down into two different kinds of experience. One is the experience of looking at the magazine, of engaging with photography through that particular kind of artifact. And then the second experience is the experience of the photographer working for the magazine. You know, there's two kind of different situations there.
So one being, how do I get... how do I fill my head with images and visual education along the lines of what we used to get from flipping through a magazine? And the other one is making images in a world where magazines, frankly, don't exist like they did in the past. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. And I think from the photographer making work perspective, what we're talking about with editorial photography is images and text.
Yes, 100%. Absolutely.
So let's kick this off then, shall we, with one of the people you've been speaking to.
Well, I decided to talk to three photographers who worked for and shot for Life magazine when I was the editor. They all made great and memorable contributions, for which, of course, I'm grateful. And I did this in part, well, because they're great photographers, but also because Life magazine was a victim of the great digital ad migration, you know, and it shut down after a few years. And so I thought that was just kind of a nice sub theme. So I want to start with a name that you will know, because when I spoke to him, the first thing he said was, "Oh, Grant, I learned so much from him."
Wow. Who's that?
Well, I think I'm going to keep you on the edge of your seat for a moment. One, two, three. Okay. Jake Chesham.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that's very funny, because I mentioned Jake on last week's podcast, because he was the year below me at St. Martin's.
So he says.
Yeah. And I gave him his first ever commission.
So he says. So I did not know that when I contacted him. All I knew, because I don't really keep track of who you went to college with, but as much as I should, but I contacted him because he made a truly memorable cover for Life magazine when I was there of Chris Rock, which I think about all the time. Anyway, for those who don't know him, Jake is a total class act who went to school a year after Grant. And he shot for every magazine imaginable. I'm sure you can chime in here. But he's shot everyone from Anthony Bourdain and Kate Moss and Emma Stone and Robert De Niro and Pharrell and Questlove. So
he's also from South London. He's born about 3 miles from where I was born.
Okay. So I asked Jake what he missed about editorial photography, and he answered in a long stream, which I think goes to his passion for this subject. And so we'll sort of break in here and there, and Grant, you know, stop me whenever you want to chime in, and we can start dissecting. So I asked him what he missed, and he started like this. He told me, "I shot the campaigns for the first 2 seasons of Ted Lasso, and seeing these plastered around town was great. And I've just shot healthcare campaigns, and I'm excited because it's going to be on billboards in New York City's Penn Station. But I miss seeing my editorial work in physical form. When I was shooting the lookbook for New York Magazine," and for those who don't know that, the lookbook came out weekly, and it was a super popular sort of street style spread that everybody, even people like me who don't really understand fashion or style in the slightest, would turn to it because the images were so captivating. So when I was shooting the lookbook for New York Magazine, I would know people were looking at my photo when I would see them rotate their magazine 90 degrees to look at the double page spread on the subway. And that happened quite often. If you were working for a magazine that was considered cool, then the right people would seek out that publication. That's how I got my break in New York, when the creative director of JFK Jr.'s political magazine, it was called George, was working on the direction for the magazine. He turned to The Face in London to find new names to shoot for him. And that's how we found Jake. So this, let's take a break for 1 second. This idea that we talked a little bit about last episode of magazines being for photographers, a promotional tool in a way.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, interestingly enough, in Jake's year was another photographer you may have heard of called Platon.
And yes, of course.
And he also was picked up at that same time. And in my year was a photographer called Miles Aldridge that you may also be aware of.
That's a pretty good year.
Yeah, and there were an awful lot of other people there as well that you would know in those couple of years. But all of us were working for magazines. I was at Elle. Others were working for The Face, for Arena, ID, all at that same time. So yes, that was one of those kind of platforms where your work got seen. And I suppose this is very much that experience from the photographer's perspective. Now, of course, that's one of the things I'm talking about, which has been lost, which I wonder how it then gets replaced. Because, you know, Jake has, from the very beginning, he always had a Tumblr account, and he would have this thing called the Daily Chessum, and every day he would put up pictures, and he's really good on Instagram, and he works very hard sort of maintaining that. But I wonder, you know, the thing he's talking about there was the curation of his work in those magazines. An art director or an editor was choosing him. Whereas, of course, now via Instagram and so forth, there isn't anybody there kind of pushing him in your direction.
Yes, you have to, you know, as media has become more personal and personally curated, right? And that curation has to do with what you do intentionally. Oh, I want to follow Jake Chessum. And it also has to do with the algorithm. You know, if you like five people whose work is sort of similar to Jake Chessum, you know, you might get fed Jake Chessum. I say this a little bit reluctantly. You know, I do this Instagram thing most Fridays where I do try to curate and bring photographers to people who may not have heard or seen them. And the comment I get more than anything else is, I never knew about this person. Thanks for showing me his or her work. And so I think you're so right that people are starved for good curation and surprise.
Well, that's what you're doing with the Instagram, and it's what I'm trying to do with the podcast every week, and having a different photographer on and saying, look, here's someone you've probably never heard of. Here's someone you may have heard of. Here's somebody working in an area that you've probably got no interest in. But hey, listen, look, we're all similar. We're all the same. We're all having the same conversation. What else did Jake have to say? Because when Jake gets talking, he very rarely stops.
This is in fact true. So he continues and he says, back then, I was shooting editorial sometimes four or five times a week. Part of that was probably the stage of my career, but a lot of it was the sheer number and diversity of magazines. I miss the excitement of the number of assignments I used to get and their diversity. Politicians, actors, business people, comedians, chefs, sports people, reportage stories about current affairs. It was quite social, too. And this, I think, is important for us to get into, Grant. It was quite social, too, going into the offices for meetings to hand off edits, to hand off prints, to discuss ideas. So much of that gradually eroded, first with the arrival of email, but more spectacularly by the arrival of digital. My retoucher lives in Sweden. We've never met. So that's clearly something that is missing today, which I hear from photo editors as well as photographers, is that they miss that in the moment give and take and exchange of ideas that can be so fruitful and thrilling.
But, you know, that's such a social issue, isn't it? In the broader sense of the word social, you know, we're hearing so much in a post-COVID, you know, you and I have never clinked a glass of wine together. You know, we've only ever met through Zoom and through social media. So, you know, our friendship, our relationship, I suppose, is based on exactly that thing that we're talking about.
100%. And I think for photographers who might feel that is missing, that sort of social connection and the creative juice you get from banging ideas around, you know, I do think in that situation, you know, there are things that they can at least try to do to, and again, I'm going to use that word again, recreate that or some sense of it, or at least inject it into their life. You know, there are photographic meetups, which are easy to find and fairly easy to get going on Instagram, where you can actually, you know, obviously go off, walk somewhere with other photographers and take a bunch of pictures. I think that's great. I think trying to take a photo editor out to lunch is something that is incumbent on a photographer to do. And quite honestly, it might be worth reaching down the masthead, not up the masthead, because it's the younger photo editors, frankly, who need taking to lunch because they don't have as much money. But also those people will grow and will become decision makers, you know, pretty quickly.
Yeah. And as I said, you know, I've known Jake since we were both at college together. So it's a perfect example of you grow up with the people of your age as you work your way. And here we are now, what, 40 odd years later, and we're still in the same business and we're still engaged with the same things. I think you're right. I think there is a push without a doubt for people to get back into the office. That's not going to be, I don't think, anything more than hybrid. And there is, of course, that this issue around any form of publishing, that lunch is now a sandwich and a bottle of water at the desk. Whereas back in our day, Bill, and certainly in my day, and as Jake, I'm sure, will remember, it was start at 12:30, get back to the office by 3, a couple of bottles of wine in Soho, and everything was good in the world. So, but that idea of the long lunch has definitely gone.
It has. But I, and setting booze and good food aside, I do miss those moments when you just sit down and fairly uninterrupted, just talk about ideas or what have you seen and what are you feeling and what's out there. And I do think, to the extent that photographers can try to push for that, they would do well.
I agree with you. And I think from a positive perspective, one of the things I completely agree is that it is up to photographers to try and recreate some kind of a social situation. I think I spoke last week on the podcast about what Jake and James Dimmock are doing with their Farringdon print shop, where the two of them have got together again. They're selling their prints from the 90s, and they're making something happen for themselves. And I think perhaps that is the positive takeaway from this.
Right. And look, if it means that you and three other photographers in your city get together once a month and talk about photo books, great.
Or get together and don't talk about photography.
Absolutely.
You know, just get together. I think that's the key.
Jake continues to say, some of the things a younger generation won't be exposed to maybe won't matter. Waiting anxiously to see if the film came out, hanging around for clip tests. The things, you know, those won't matter. The things they'll miss are the travel to different cities and countries. It was normal to jump on a plane to shoot a photo. I once went to Calgary from New York with my assistant to shoot Heath Ledger. The photo ran as a quarter page. A day trip to Morocco to shoot Ewan McGregor. Life magazine flew me from London to LA for a 20-minute shoot with Kirk Douglas. Okay, so this was on my watch. I did not know that. When Jake told me that, I was horrified. But be that as it may.
Would you know, I was once sent to the North Pole for a shoot that took an hour.
That's insane.
Yeah.
But that's how it was.
But that's how it was. You know, you're absolutely right. And it's funny, actually, just kind of going off a bit of a tangent with that. But one of the things I hear most from student photographers is they say to me that they want to be photographers because they want to travel. And I always say, well, why don't you train to fly to fly a plane? Because that's travel. Because nowadays in photography, you're just not going to travel that much.
Right.
You know, local photographers are going to be used for a number of really good reasons.
So is there anything other than learning how to fly a plane that photographers can do to feed that Jones?
Well, I think, you know, it's this personal project thing again, isn't it? This is why we've spoken so much about personal projects. It's why photographers are engaged with them, is that if you're going to do that, if you want to do that, you're going to have to self-fund it. And whereas you could rely on editorial photography or magazine to send you wherever it needed to be.
I mean, I guess the other thing you could try to do is to find an NGO that is working in some country that you want to visit, or, you know,
Yeah, I mean, if that's the kind of documentary work that you're doing and you can make work for yourself or whatever, I think what we're really talking about is that where we are now is that there is more reliance on the photographer to make it work for them than perhaps it was before.
To be proactive, to think about what you want and what you need to do to get that thing.
Yeah. Did Jake add any more?
Oh, indeed he did. he continued, knowing you would have maybe a few minutes to get the shot was extremely stressful, but I loved it. I learned, in large part through the advice of Grant, how to shoot as much as possible in the time available and to cover as many different options as possible. Knowing that you might be shooting a cover, TOC, opener, turn page, made you work really hard and fast to get diverse images. And commercially, being aware that the more you got, the more you could sell later on to other publications.
I'm sure he's referring to the David Bowie shoot when he's talking about that.
Yeah, yes, he is. Most of us were striving to use the editorial as a stepping stone to ad campaigns and music jobs. So that avenue has closed off to a great extent, or has shifted to having tons of Instagram followers in order to get a shoot campaign. To try to increase your Instagram following to influencer status at this point, with the app being so mature and the ecosystem being so mature, is going to be very difficult.
Yeah, I agree. And I think also my sort of note of warning as I become increasingly jaded with social media, having been sort of very active for a long time, you've got to be very careful to put your future into the hands of someone you have no idea what their intentions are. So before you put your career in the hands of Meta, make sure you're aware that that's what you're doing.
And at the same time, you can't really avoid it, nor personally do I think you should avoid it, because the chief way that I, for example, find photographers that I write about on my Instagram is through Instagram.
Yeah, I agree with you. You have to be involved with it, but you also have to be aware that it can disappear as quickly as it arrived.
Which brings up the point of newsletters, where you know Substack or whatnot, you know, where you create your own audience, you hold your audience, not Meta, for example. I still love to shoot editorial whenever I get the opportunity, which is once or twice a month. I've been fortunate to maintain ad and commercial work. I'm shooting a couple of long-term personal projects, working on a book, who isn't, and also spend quite a bit of time on my archive. And now he mentions what you mentioned last week. I sell fine art prints through a number of galleries, and in fact, have just started one of my own with photographer James Dimmock. I had the accidental foresight to never throw any negs or shoots away. My 1990 shoots with Kate Moss, 1994 shoots with the Beastie Boys, 1995 with Bowie, thanks Grant, 2004 shoot with Amy Winehouse are all good sellers. Important piece of advice: don't throw anything out unless you are 100% sure it won't be useful in the future.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well, because I can remember he and I used to get the train from East Croydon with Kate Moss when she first started out, because we were all from that area of South London. And so what he was very good at was he was documenting the people we were growing up with, and now has those images from their very earliest days.
Okay, so that's really important. The people that you're growing up with, the young people or your peers who are on the rise. And also, I am always kind of blown away when I see pictures of neighborhoods from the 80s, from the 70s, sometimes from even in the early 90s, that are just kind of, you know, well done shots of the neighborhood. But 30 to 40 years later, those images have a cultural zip to them, and a nostalgia, and people like to time travel. So when Jake Chesham says shoot everything in every, you know, format, motion pictures, I agree, because those things, the shoe store on the corner, you know, the pub in the middle of the block, those things that look so pedestrian now, 30, 40 years from now, they may not.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I still have a copy of Jake's first book, which I think came out about 20 odd years ago, which I think he self-published, called Rubbish. And it's just photographs of rubbish, which is very Jake. Who else did you speak to, Bill?
I spoke with Aaron Patrice O'Brien. Aaron is a terrific photographer, and she has shot over 100 hip hop artists, from Missy Elliott to Lil Wayne to LL Cool J to Erykah Badu. She made portraits of all the actors at Sundance, at the Sundance Film Festival for Premiere and Entertainment Weekly. She shot for Vibe, Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, and of course for Life, where she did a great cover, cover and cover story about the American Girl doll craze. Some years ago, her advertising campaigns include the Chappelle Show, Xbox, and Motorola. So she's quite accomplished. I said to Aaron, now that editorial assignments have for so many photographers sort of faded away, what do you think is missing and what do you miss? And she said, what I miss is working closely with a photo editor to develop a feature for a magazine. I miss the travel and the experience of the assignment to document someone's life or a specific news story. Specifically, I miss the access that was granted when working for publications. I miss the budgets, but I try not to dwell on how it used to be. There are many things that are easier now, and I think that the photographers who are determined and curious will have a different experience that can be equally fulfilling.
Do you know what that makes me think is that I just love these conversations we have, because they really kind of force me to reconsider things I think I know, but also kind of introduce these new thought patterns. And what I was just thinking there was that actually, as magazine people, which we were facilitators, both financially and in giving the opportunity for photographers to go to places, to meet people, to be in environments that ordinarily they weren't able to access.
We were able to say yes.
Yeah.
And that was a tremendous gift, to say yes, go to Morocco, to shoot Ewan McGregor or whatever, or God, fly to LA to shoot Kirk Douglas for 20 minutes.
Oh, you think that's bad? I once lost Stephen Klein and Sharon Fenn in the desert for a week. So, you know, seriously, I once also had another photographer in the south of France who just ran up bills for an entire summer. So, yeah, you know, there were photographers who took advantage of our good natures, Bill.
That is 100% true. Yeah. Okay. I asked Aaron, are there any ways that a photographer today can somehow make up for the loss of editorial assignments? And she said, and we've talked about this, having your own personal projects that are meaningful is very important. I try to have my camera on me as much as possible so that I'm used to the weight of it. I push myself to shoot things all the time. I make connections with artists who inspire me. I like the idea of making connections with artists who inspire me. And as a photographer, to be able to get in touch with an artist and just say, or a writer or whoever, and just say, I'd love to make your portrait. No, it's not for the face. It's not for New York Magazine. It's not for Life, but I'd like to make your portrait. It's flattering. And if the person, you know, is not Kate Moss, they might say yes. So give it a crack.
Yeah, I agree. And it's something that I say again and again and again when I'm talking or lecturing about photography. However, I really am trying my best here to be super positive and I never like to put up barriers to things. However, I think it's important to understand that as facilitators, we were able to kind of jump over the agent or get through to the agent. And I think increasingly now, and I know this from my own experience, that it's really hard to get through to the person who you know will say yes, but there are gatekeepers there who don't really understand the intention.
Okay, so I want to, I think this is an interesting point because, I think you may be talking about rightly, certainly A-list people, maybe B-list people. But I do think, thanks to social media, a lot of people who are up and coming, for example, a first-time author, a new band, a new painter, would love to and will say yes, in part because they probably don't have a gatekeeper. Or more to the point, you can reach them directly on Instagram or some other social media platform because they are probably at a stage where they are managing their own account. So if you are in New York City and see a gallery show, a painter, a gallery show at a small gallery, chances are that painter would love to pose for you and be able to use those pictures as promotion or publicity later on for their own use.
Yeah, I completely agree. And as you know, the premise behind the two photography courses I run now, the undergraduate and the postgraduate, is that all of our students are allowed to photograph whatever they want from the first moment they arrive based on their passions and their interests. So whatever you're interested in, whatever you're passionate about, go and reach out to people. And if you want to spend 3 years or a year on the MA just doing that, that's what we encourage. So I totally agree with that. I just wish that there wasn't that kind of PA agent kind of wall.
Yeah, I mean, and that wall, in 2004, 5, 6, and 7, at Life, we saw shoots go from and at 90 minutes to 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And of course, in the old days of Life, you would get the great John Dominus spent 3 weeks with Steve McQueen.
Yeah.
3 weeks.
Yeah.
So the gatekeepers have certainly had their way with photographers.
Yeah. Well, yeah, one way or another. So yes. What else did Erin have to say?
I asked Erin, what are you focusing on these days? And she says, nowadays, I shoot a mixture of portraits, music, reportage, and higher education. Some universities have alumni magazines, which I'm going to say parenthetically is another avenue. So, you shoot an up and coming painter or whatever, you can then find out where they went to college, if they went to college, and then pitch those pictures as a story to the alumni magazine.
Yeah, that'll work in the US, not in the UK.
Fair enough.
We don't have that kind of alumni kind of magazine culture here.
That's interesting. Well, the alumni magazines here are often very well funded, quite glossy, because the purpose is to keep people attached to the university so they'll donate. So she goes on and she says, I will shoot for artists a portrait package, which can be used for promo and marketing across social media and at clubs. Coming from an editorial background, I like to work with my clients to make photos that will end up being the cover of a brochure for a festival in which they'll appear. At the end of the day, being a photographer, she says, is always a hustle.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's where we are this week, where the discussion is going to, is that whereas previously the art director, the editor of the magazine was doing the hustle for you and kind of giving you the call and saying, listen, we've done all the hard work. We've spent the last few weeks arguing with the agent. We've got this set up for you and we're going to pay you. Unfortunately, the photographer now has to take on that role.
So I think that is such an insightful comment. And so it becomes incumbent on the photographer who wants to do these kind of shoots, even at a lower level, again, not A-list, because that's probably not going to happen. It becomes incumbent on the photographer to develop those relationships over time, to reach out, to facilitate. If the painter or the author is going on a trip, maybe it's, hey, can I come along with you to Palm Springs and shoot you there? It is a hustle. And I think, to your point, photographers have to start thinking like photo editors and like magazine editors in developing long-term relationships and figuring out how to get themselves in position to take the pictures they want to take.
Yeah, I think the difficulty, of course, is, and I can hear photographers screaming at the speaker or wherever they're listening to this, saying, yeah, that's all very well, but how am I going to get paid?
Well, so that's right. I think it becomes a long-term investment, much more than it was in the past. There's a young photographer who I know, and his name is escaping me, but I think it's Matt Weinberger, but we'll put it in the show notes, who's 24, 25 years old. He's going out to all the New York City underground parties, and he's shooting all the cool kids. And his pictures are getting better. He's getting recognized. He's starting to get invited to premieres and parties and fashion shows. And his hustle, because he has a day job, that's something else entirely, in a different field. But every night he's committed and he goes out and he shoots and he stays out late and he puts his pictures on Instagram and they are getting noticed.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? We've spoken about the photographer Daffy Jones on the podcast before.
Yes.
Daffy's contributed. And of course, you know, he's still producing books of all of those parties he went to in the 80s and so forth. But he's still covering the parties as well. He hasn't stopped.
Right.
You said you spoke to three people, Bill. Who was the third in this triptych?
Well, I spoke to the great Chris Buck, who I love. Chris is a super creative, and if you don't know his work, he's a funny photographer. And he shot everyone from President Obama to Willie Nelson to Lena Dunham to Nas, and for everyone, The New Yorker, New Music Express, Guardian Saturday, The New York Times Magazine, and of course for Life. And he did a brilliant cover of Steve Carell for us, which was a literally Steve Carell posed in a classic Life magazine, 1950s profile. But then he took a second shot of Carell doing a literal spit take with water coming out of his mouth. And we were able to run that as a double cover, like you see the normal picture first and then the spit coming out. And it was great. And
so it's like a gatefold.
Yeah, it was kind of like a gatefold. His advertising clients include Coca-Cola, Google, and Microsoft. So he's quite an accomplished photographer.
You know, I'm just going to say, Bill, just to interrupt you. For me, you've spoken to two of the greatest editorial magazine photographers we've had for the last 40, 50 years in Jake and Chris. I think for me, they are the epitome of what makes a great magazine photographer.
Tell me what makes a great magazine photographer.
I think a sense of understanding that a photograph can also be entertaining as well as revealing or humorous. It can be conceptual. It can be documentary. It can be any of those things. And although Chris's work is, I think, much more controlled than Jake's more freewheeling, they both have a very similar kind of approach to their work.
I'm fans of these three photographers, and that's why I wanted to talk about this, because they are so prolific, all of them, and so expert that I just thought they would have. Anyway,
yeah.
Chris says, and he has a lot to say. He says, 20 years ago, I shot for a range of clients, from scrappy music places to well-funded business magazines to high-end prestige publications. Now a lot of those magazines don't exist, and they won't come back. The fact is that I have fewer clients now, but most of them are big name flagship publications. I might be doing less work, but it's largely for The New Yorker, The Guardian, The New York Times Magazine. In 1990, I had the chance to interview the great photographer Arnold Newman. At one point in our conversation, he told me a story about taking his portfolio into a meeting with a young art director. This art director started off being dismissive, but changed his attitude as he flipped through Newman's book with important cultural figures of the 20th century, multiple presidents, art world icons, etc. Newman relayed this as a kind of badge of honor, that he would not be dismissed or disrespected. But it struck me as sad that a professional of his caliber couldn't find a place in the early 90s magazine world. Newman wasn't getting many professional commissions at the time when my career was just beginning. I saw endless opportunities, and he spent most of his time giving lectures and organizing his archive. What do you think about that?
Well, I can remember it very well. I can remember that time. I can remember phoning William Klein and commissioning William Klein to shoot for me. And no one was shooting him. No one was asking him to shoot for them. So he had no work at that time. And nor did Jean-Luc Sieff, who I also commissioned. And neither of them were working at all. And there was a really big change in the 90s and almost a rejection against those kind of icons of photography. And I don't think that has changed. I think that there is, that's kind of part of the nature of magazine photography. When young art directors come in, they often want to use people who are of similar age to them. I was sort of saw myself as a bit of a Jehovah, sort of bringing people back from the dead. And I'm really pleased I was able to do that. Leonard Fried was another photographer I commissioned who wasn't getting any work at the time. Now, there are many others I could mention.
Is there any wisdom or help that we can offer to either younger photographers who in 20 years will be older photographers or to older photographers now?
I don't think so. I think that, again, I don't want to come over as negative, but I think it's just the way of things. The other problem, of course, now with magazines is that there isn't that, this is difficult to say, but I'm going to say it. There isn't that quality or interest in photography amongst the people who are commissioning, certainly from a UK perspective. And therefore, they don't have that knowledge of Arnold Newman or the history. So I think it's better to not try and kind of persuade people that you are relevant if they don't perceive you as being relevant. And it's better actually to find your tribe, as it were, and to actually show the work to the people who will get what you do. So in a sense, I think Newman was right in what he was doing. Terry Donovan was exactly the same. I mean, you know, it was a terrible situation at the end because he wouldn't get commissioned.
Well, it's funny you say that because I was going to ask you about the following strategy. Let's say that you are an older photographer. Let's say that you're our age and, you know, in your late 50s, you were established, you were something of a name at some point. What if you did go to these cool kid nightclub places, for example, where more of the younger scene is happening and you make pictures, and with your skill and your experience, with everything from personal interactions to lighting to God knows whatever framing, your pictures stand out. They are better than the 22-year-olds who are taking pictures of the same thing. Do you think that that's a strategy, or is that a waste of time?
I think it's great if you were Bill Cunningham and it worked for Bill Cunningham, but I think it is a waste of time because at the end of the day, you're going to have to go somewhere with those pictures and show them to somebody who might be young and cool and kind of thinking, okay, I need the new young, cool thing, and be unaware and unable to recognize the quality in the work. I'm sounding really kind of down on it, but you know,
where I'm going is almost a Cyrano direction in my head. Like you're this older photographer. Maybe you start a new persona on Instagram with a new name and a new branding that feels younger, but your skills.
Don't you remember Elliot Erwitt did that, and he created a fake name, and he was wearing glasses and a beard, and he did.
I didn't know that. Tell me.
Yeah, he did a whole book of photography and pretending to be a completely different photographer, and you know, in a very Elliot Erwitt kind of a way. You know, I think it's very difficult. The magazine world has it's pretty shallow. Unless you're getting to the heavyweight magazines, you know, a lot of it is pretty shallow. And therefore, the people who are working on them, you know, they're doing a good job and they're doing the best they can, but they don't have the commitment and the passion to the media.
Well, wait. But they also are being asked to do three times more than people did in the past. And they don't have the budgets to pass on to photographers.
Well, no, but this is a really good point because this is the point that I bring up in the Inside Vogue House book, which kind of started this conversation, is that there used to be a baton changing of experience and knowledge. And I learned from people who had been working in the 60s and 70s when I started to learn in the 80s. And so when Jake says he learned from me, in reality, he was learning from me because I'd learned from others. But as we got into the early 2000s, with budget cuts, with the closures of magazines, with teams getting smaller, the people who were being paid a lot of money, like me and other art directors, we weren't needed anymore, and therefore we weren't paid, and therefore that was it. We moved into other areas, and the people who replaced us didn't have the opportunity to learn from other people.
And then, of course, that's been accentuated and accelerated with COVID and being working remotely. You know, you're not even in the same room as somebody who learned from somebody else.
There's a really good point about that as well, though, Bill, which is that, you know, the new editor, there is no longer an editor of Vogue magazine in Britain. The title now is Editor of Editorial Content. Now, I've just seen the first issue of that magazine, and it is an absolute car crash because the person who's putting it together, I'm sure she's doing her best and what have you, and I hate talking negatively about these things, but it looks like she's only ever done a website, and a website isn't a magazine. It's a different thing. So the typography is terrible. The layout is terrible. The pagination is awful. The photographs are just dire. And you sort of think this is because you've not learned from good people.
I mean, we've seen this again and again in the States where they take the head of digital content, who's done a great job with the website, and put them also in charge of the magazine, and it's a disaster.
Yeah,
they're very different skills, and it's not to that person's fault because, you know, I can't juggle, so don't ask me to juggle.
No, me neither. So
let me continue with what Chris Buck told me. Can you find data to support a narrative where photography isn't as valued as it once was 15 years ago, or that there are less opportunities for young shooters? Absolutely. But the marketplace is always changing, and serious, ambitious people will always find their place in it. I imagine that if I were a young, driven shooter today, I would look for the opportunities for creative outlets and financial gain. Nothing incentivizes like having an open calendar with no income coming in. There have always been a number of places where one can get some experience, learn about professionalism, have some adventures in photography. One can develop personal projects that are self-driven with their own deadlines and creative goals. Lots of people work with NGOs or with brands directly. People sometimes get staff jobs with organizations. I do wonder, he said to me, if you've asked the wrong person for today's podcast, as I'm an optimist by nature. I loved being a photographer in the 90s and the aughts, but I'm excited for what photography can do over the next 10, 20, and 50 years. It's a dynamic medium with so many possibilities that have barely been explored.
Well, do you know what, Chris? If you're listening to this, you're the right person to ask, because that's exactly how we feel about photography. And I hope we don't come over as being too kind of naysayer about it. But I agree with him, you know, but what this all seems to be coming down to, the last conversation and everything else, is what we've been saying, personal projects, working directly with brands, and actually accepting the fact that the facilitator has gone and you are now the facilitator.
And you use the word, well, I mean, one of us used the word hustle. And
that would have been you. I think that's an American thing.
Okay. So you use self-facilitator and I used hustle. I guess that's about where the countries come down. So,
yeah.
But either way, more is incumbent on the photographer to make connections, be strategic, think like a photo editor. And that's hard work, but that's what it takes.
It's quite interesting. When I run the course, as I said, at Oxford Brookes University, I bring in a lot of photographers who have never been academics, who are not teachers, who maybe have never taught before. And that's like a real USP of the course. So I bring these guys in. And quite often, the bit they struggle with is the sort of taking ownership of a module of the course, of taking ownership of the admin side. And they kind of look to me to do that. Well, because that's what you let an art director do. You know, that's what the editor does. That's what the client does. And I think there's an interesting kind of mind switch required there for the photographer to actually recognize how much facilitating was done for them, and just kind of having to just to take it on board and do that. And the photographers I know who do really well with their long form projects and produce really great books and exhibitions, they are really good at all of that other stuff.
You know, I know a couple of photographers who have realized about themselves that they're not great at that, which is a big and important realization. And they have sought out consultants or career coaches, you know, for an hour, for 2 hours, to help them think about and come up with a training plan or a strategic plan for themselves. And I got to say, I think that's a great idea. And if it costs you a couple of $100 or pounds to start to learn a new skill set, by God, that is worth it. And at least in this country, it's a tax write-off.
Well, it would be here as well. I think that that's very interesting in itself, because that requires the photographer to accept where we are and also then to be proactive in saying, I need to learn new skills. I can't just keep saying, oh, woe is me. I need to adapt. New soft skills, transferable skills are required. And however you choose to gain those is fine. We haven't even begun. I mean, we've done all this talking and we haven't even begun to speak about the idea of the second experience, which is the experience of the reader of the magazine. We've got so focused on the idea of the working for the magazine, but I really think that the experience of holding, looking at the magazine is maybe something, I hate to say this, Bill, this could be the first ever three-part element of the conversation. What do you think?
I love it. I would love to talk about the reading experience of a magazine, because as editors, you and I try to create a great experience for readers. And you know, I'd love to ask our listeners if they want to send in any comments to us, not only about what we talked about today, but about what they used to get and what they still get from magazines, what magazines they're reading, and sort of what they like and what they miss.
Yeah, I think that would be really interesting, because I do know that there is a big growth area in subscriptions to magazines. I know it's always been a big thing in the States, but it wasn't a big thing in the UK. But I think a lot of people now do feel that if there is perhaps a special interest magazine in particular, that they'll feel a connection with that magazine to actually support it as well as enjoy it.
So let's ask people to send us some of the magazines that they're loving now and what they like about it.
Yeah, I think that would be great. And also, I'm going to add something to that. If you're listening to this, tell us, how much do you actually want to pay for a magazine? I see some magazines now, UK price, £20, which is pretty much $20 as we currently sit. And at the same time, I speak about that latest Vogue. I bought it in my local supermarket the other day at the special price of £2. So $2. So they're desperate to try and get you to buy that. Maybe the next issue we'll talk about the black art of selling magazines and subscriptions and circulations and so forth, as long as we don't get too far away from photography. Anyway, as you can tell, listeners, Bill and I can talk about this forever. I hope you're enjoying this element of the conversation. Your feedback so far says you are. The listening figures have just gone through the roof through this part of the conversation. So I guess you are enjoying it. So we're going to give you a little bit more of it. Bill, thanks as always. Really great. Thanks, Jake. Thanks, Aaron. And thanks, Chris, for their input. Because without that input, we don't have something to kind of bounce around off each other as much. And I really look forward to catching up with you again in the next episode, where we, I think we're going to have to put editorial photography to bed for a while, but we're going to look at it from the perspective of the viewer, the reader.
I love it. I can't wait.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Bye, Grant.
Thank you for listening this week, and don't forget to take care.